This morning I want to speak to you, brethren, about fear. Does anyone here suffer from a phobia? Because a phobia is a fear of something or someone or some specific situation. Now, I've got here something I downloaded from the internet. There are 410 phobias listed here, fears that people have. There seems to be a phobia for absolutely everything, which suggests that there are lots of people who have fears of all sorts of different things. Some I'm sure you will have heard of, like fear of spiders, which is arachnophobia, or claustrophobia, which is the fear of confined spaces. And there's one I'm sure that 90% of the people I know suffer from, and that's dentophobia, fear of the dentist. How about cacorhaphiophobia? This means fear of failure or defeat. Scotophobia?
No.
It doesn't mean fear of people like me, Scott. It means a fear of the dark. Aquaphobia means fear of water. My 15-year-old stepson suffers from aquaphobia, but only, it seems, when it's got soap in it. So here's two that might apply to me and perhaps some of the other people you see coming up here to speak. It's laliophobia, which means a fear of speaking, and homiliophobia, which is a fear of sermons. Now, each year, about July, when the assignments come out for the feast, I've personally become quite agitated. No, what am I going to speak about? How am I going to make it last for about an hour and so on? Now, personally, I'd rather be listening to a sermon than giving one. The one last phobia from this long list is one I think probably applies to all of us, and that is hamartophobia, which means a fear of sinning. Now, there are people who have serious problems with various fears or phobias, so I don't mean to make light of this, but I want to ask a question to us. Do we, who believe we have been selected by God out of all humanity at this time for a special purpose, despite the fact that we are the weak of the world, do we, because of our weakness, live in fear? Or do we generally live in peace and tranquility? Now, apart from the hundreds of phobias that can affect people, there are areas in the world where people live in constant danger and fear of being killed or injured. Consider the recent times in Israel, Iraq, or Afghanistan. If you or I were a citizen living in these countries each day we'd carry the danger of being the victim of a suicide bomber. Someone we did not know and who did not know us, but who, because of their persuasion, be it religious or political, did not consider it evil to take innocent lives. It's not so long ago that a similar situation existed in Northern Ireland. I used to go there quite a lot on work assignments. And a few years ago I was over there carrying out an audit, and working in this office with two people who lived there. And suddenly there was a loud bang, and the two people who were local dived out of the office. They freaked out totally. I don't recall ever finding out what caused the bang, but these two local people had assumed it was a terrorist bomb. And their reaction was an indication that because of the troubles over there, when at that time bombs were frequent and many innocent people lost their lives, they were living in a condition of fear. Now, I didn't react at all, because back in Scotland I lived in a relatively safe situation, and bangs were few, and where there were bangs there were certainly never bombs. I recall another situation I was told about, where two ladies from Northern Ireland were visiting Scotland, and they went shopping in one of the big department stores in Glasgow. It used to be in some of these stores, I think it's changed nowadays, that if a cash assistant needed help, needed change, or needed relieving, there's this bell. And they used to thump this bell and it would ring, giving quite a loud ring, so that the supervisor, who might be anywhere in the store, would hear it and come at it and attend to their needs. Now, apparently, that some of the places in Ireland had similar bells. And where there was something, a terrorist attack, or some threat of a bomb, this bell would ring and people would scamper out of the road. Now, these two ladies, when they heard this bell, dived to the floor. instinctively dive to the floor. And you can imagine how embarrassed they were when they realised they weren't in Belfast, they were in Glasgow. But they were conditioned by the environment they lived in at home. And this sound of this bell had caused fear in them, and this fear resulted in them doing what they did. Ever since the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York on the 11th of September 2003, there has been a fear of terrorist attacks around the world. This has been fueled by bombs in Bali, and there was one recently there, and then this year in London. Now, I have a sister who lives just outside London, and she travels into the centre of the town every day to work. Normally, she takes the train, then the bus, or the tube. Since the July attacks, she does not any longer take the bus or the tube. She walks. Now, walking in London cannot be safe either, but she prefers to walk. She's a fear of travelling in a bus or on the tube train. And she's not alone. A lot of people who work in London now, rather than take the bus or the tube, take their pedal cycles or they walk. People who used to use public transport before the 7th of July this year. And when we were on holiday this year in Spain, we decided to take a short train ride to the next town down the coast. And my little daughter was not at all sure she wanted to take the train. And do you know why? Because the day we had left home to go on holiday was the day the bomber struck in London. And she had in her mind that they bombed trains. And I had to reassure her that I had asked God's protection, as I had, that he would protect us whatever we were doing, and this helped to settle her for the journey. Now, these terrible terrorist attacks might be remote from most of us, but what about the things closer at hand? In recent times, there have been scares that could affect any of us. The illness CJD, which is believed to come from infections that have got into the food chain, caused, we must say, by man's ignorance and breaking of God's law of hygiene and husbandry. Cattle which God designed to eat the vegetation have been fed man-made food, sometimes made from diseased sheep. The disease in this food infected the cattle and stayed in the food chain and was spread to humans. It has even been suggested recently that the disease was able to spread to humans because some imported cattle feed, now listen to this is shocking, some imported cattle feed contained human remains. And that's how the virus in the cattle was able to infect humans. It mutated because there was human cells in these cattle. It mutated and was then able to infect humans who ingested infected meat. Now, until steps were taken to prevent further proliferation of this disease, none of us know whether or not we or our loved ones might have eaten any of this infected meat. And the scientists tell us it might be 20 or so years before the disease manifests itself in the infected human. Now, whether this is true or not, I can't say. I don't know. I'm not an expert. But we have seen several cases in the UK of this disease, but mostly in young people. Young people who've contracted this horrible disease and become virtual vegetables in a few weeks. Recently, there was a scare here, and I think possibly in other parts of the world, over the red dye Sudan that was contaminating some brands of Worcester sauce. Now, for visitors, Worcester sauce is a commonly used sauce in the UK. And because this sauce was used in hundreds of other products, these two were contaminated and had to be taken out of circulation. Again, we don't know whether we might have eaten some of these foods or not. Even if we never bought them, we might have eaten them in a restaurant or when visiting a friend. Now, there was an article in the November 2004 Reader's Digest titled, "How Safe Is Your Food?" It discussed the diseases that can and do come through the food chain, such as E. coli, Listeria, Salmonella, and Campylobacter. The article talks particularly about a little boy called Drew Gray. This boy almost died after eating pork chops, which were infected by E. coli. Now, we don't eat pork chops, but it can affect other food. Let me quote from the article. It says bacteria can find their way into our food at every stop along the trail, from farm to table, from farmyard, slaughterhouse, processing plant, butcher shop, eating outlet, and family kitchen. Scientists cannot say for sure where contamination is most likely to occur. And fecal contamination is often the culprit. Meat and poultry are frequent sources. The adherence to the basic laws of hygiene and proper cooking could eliminate most of this contamination. But the article goes on to say, there are many causes of food contamination. The emergence of new germs, processing practices that may boost the risk of infection, the ongoing pressure to mass produce food at even lower prices. These are scary revelations. And don't think that going vegetarian can help people to avoid this issue. I don't know if you remember, those who were here last year, but while we were here last year, there was an outbreak, not in Chatsworth, but very close to here, there was an outbreak of sickness and diarrhea. What caused it? It was put down to people eating contaminated lettuce at fast food outlets. Lettuce that had not been washed properly, or washed with contaminated water, or perhaps somebody who had a disease was dealing with it. There now is a fear that bird flu, which has caused several deaths in Eastern Europe, in the Far East, there's now a fear that this could spread throughout the world, not only wiping out poultry supplies, but mutating into a human type of virus and becoming a lethal human disease. The UK government is trying to stockpile 120 million doses of a suitable antidote for it. Something they say they can't do until somebody gets it, funny enough. But once somebody gets it, they'll produce this, what's the word I'm looking for? A vaccine, thank you, against it. 120 million doses, that's two doses for everybody in the country. You know, vast populations in Africa live in fear of HIV infections leading to AIDS. And now we're told tuberculosis is rife in parts of that continent. In many parts of the world, people live in fear of starvation and famine. Africa, parts of India, and North Korea all have this fear to some extent at this time. What about global warming? Somebody mentioned that already this feast. Does this concern us? You know, for several years now, the scientific community claim the Earth is warming up. They haven't been to Scotland. Definitely not. Now, the cause of this is the build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, most of which is a product or a byproduct of the burning of fossil fuels like petrol, diesel, coal, wood, and so on. Now, if this does come to pass, the result will be that the ice at the poles will melt. And indeed, there is some evidence that this is already happening. As a consequence of this, sea levels will rise, devastating coastal, island, and low-lying communities around the globe. For example, London and New York could become completely submerged. Some might not think that's a bad thing, but never mind. Look how easily New Orleans became flooded by the waves whipped up by Hurricane Katrina. Now, I must have put down here, why do they always name vicious hurricanes after ladies? Maybe Solomon could tell us something about that. Now, New Orleans would probably also become flooded permanently if sea levels rise, as some think they will. Now, the scientists who think this will happen publish propaganda on it as designed to scare people, to put a fear in people in general, and governments in particular, in the hope that production of so-called greenhouse gases will be statutorily curtailed. Now, we are getting some response, but not from the biggest producers of greenhouse gases, i.e. the USA and China. There is no doubt that today's society, for the reasons we've been discussing and others we have not discussed, is living in a climate or a state of fear. Now, most people will cope with this by putting matters which might cause them concern out of their minds, completely out of their minds, or deny that there is any real problem. Now, for example, we hear today of many cases of sexual assault and murder in children. As a result of this, we and some of our children's friends, parents are cautious about the freedom we give to our children to go about unchaperoned. Others will tell us, look, this is silly. because things are no different from what they've always been. It's only that more cases are being reported today than used to be. Now that may be true. Maybe things are not so different from what they were in the past. Now, I have not long finished reading a book called Where There Is Evil. Now, in 1957, in a town in central Scotland, about 5 miles from where we stay, a young girl, a 12-year-old girl, called Moira Anderson, disappeared one cold, snowy Saturday night and was never seen again. This book, Where There Is Evil, was written by a lady called Sandra Brown, that's her married name, who believes her father, Alexander Gutshaun, was responsible for the abduction, the assault and murder of Moira Anderson. The book is a harrowing read. Alexander Gutshaun was a convicted paedophile who served just 2 years for one incident he was found guilty of committing. His daughter reveals in her book a lifetime of assaults by this man, her father. Assaults on cousins, assaults on neighbours' children and her childhood friends, among others. She gives convincing evidence that he could well have been Moira Anderson's murderer. The frightening thing about her book is that the fact that her father, who admitted to her and a newspaper reporter that he'd been questioned over the years by police about 120 suspected assaults on children, has only ever served 1 2-year sentence back in 1957. Just about the time, just after the time this little girl disappeared. Her research revealed that he and another paedophile worked together. Now, this other guy was in prison in solitary confinement for his own protection recently up in Aberdeenshire. And I read in a local paper just 4 weeks ago that this other guy had recently died and made a deathbed statement that Alexander Gutshaun was involved in the death of this little girl. And also new evidence has come about by somebody who saw something, that two men were seen annoying the girl on the night she disappeared, the second of whom probably was this guy who recently died, plus Alexander Gutshaun. Meanwhile, Mr. Gutshaun, who is now 84, walks free, and he's not far from here. He lives in Sheffield. He moved down there and he walks free. Nobody's going near him. The authorities seemed unwilling, or for some obscure reason, unable to deal with this problem back in the 1950s and 60s. And very many cases apparently were not reported because of the feeling that it would reflect badly on the victims and their families. And as bad as it was back then, I think although maybe more cases are being reported, society has changed. People have grown up in today's society without any moral guidance. The attitude towards offenders and how they should be punished has been changed to a more liberal approach. People who might have been kept locked up long ago, either in one of Her Majesty's prisons or in a hospital where they could be treated for whatever mental disorder they had, are now released to be treated in the community, rehabilitated in the community. You know, some years ago, and I think I may have related this story before, some years ago a lady who was a friend of the lady who was my secretary disappeared while out gathering berries to make jam. Her body was found very quickly. When she didn't come home, it was reported. Her body was found very quickly close to where she had been. Now, the man responsible for assaulting her and murdering her was arrested the same night. How did they manage to do that? Well, the day before this lady was murdered, this guy had been released from prison early as they do for having committed the same offence 10 years before. Clearly a case where someone should have been kept locked up. So the point of pretending that a problem does not exist does not make that problem go away. As Christians, the Bible admonishes us to keep watching the events taking place in this world, both globally and locally. Please note it down, I'm not going to turn to these scriptures, you know them, but please note it down, Matthew 24, we've visited some of them already in this piece, Matthew 24:42 and 25:13, Mark 13:33 and Acts 20:31. By watching as we have to, we cannot help but become aware of all the problems and threats that are prevalent in society and can see the prophesied condition of society slowly and surely coming to pass. Again, for an example of this, turn with me please to Isaiah 59. Isaiah chapter 59. And I want to read briefly on verse 4 here. Isaiah 59 verse 4. It says, "No one calls for justice, nor does any plead for truth. They trust in empty words and speak lies. They conceive evil and bring forth iniquity." Now please drop down to verse 7. "Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity, wasting and destruction are in their paths." Is this not what we saw in London on the 7th of July 2005? Innocent blood being shed. Is this not what we're hearing of in Iraq on a daily basis? Is this not what we've heard of in Zimbabwe, where the country's own government has destroyed its economy and its agricultural base, bringing near starvation to many? This country, Zimbabwe, has gone in a very few years from being the breadbasket, not only for itself, but for many of the countries round about it. It's gone from that to being a country desperately needing aid, food aid, for its people, and totally unable to supply any of its neighbours at all. The Zimbabwean government has been destroying people's homes, driving them into the bush where they have no food, no sanitation, and no shelter. What about Niger, where millions are faced with starvation, when there's actually more than enough food in the country to feed everyone? But it's only made available to those who can afford it. And I find that beyond understanding. It's like saying the people in Derby having no food at all, but in Nottingham, 25 miles away, they've got loads of food, but they refuse to give it to Derby unless some third party, like the United Nations, comes in and pays for it. The government of Niger is prepared to let its poor people die of starvation rather than give them food that it has available. Again, the main cause of famine in many countries is the disruption that's been caused because of war or political corruption. Now, I mentioned Zimbabwe, and Zimbabwe was once a prosperous, thriving country. But because of the policies of its ruling party, it's become a country of fear, starvation and homelessness. How about near our home? A few weeks ago, near where I live, one of these hot air balloons that was taking part in some festival was coming into land in a beautiful country park. I got near the ground in full view of the people there and many witnesses, a bunch of youths, young men appeared out of some nearby trees and started stoning this balloon. Now, had any of these stones hit the gas burner or damaged any of the supply pipes from the gas tanks on board, it could have caused a massive explosion, killing not only all the people on board the balloon, but many of the people on the ground. As it was, there was a police helicopter nearby, and someone, presumably on a mobile phone, summoned it, and when it appeared, these youths fled. Is this not the fulfillment of what we read in Isaiah? Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity, wasting, and destruction are in their paths. We constantly hear today of the emergency services, the police, the ambulance service, the fire brigade, turning up at some genuine emergency, only to be stoned by gangs of youths. We hear of babysitters abusing children in their care, old ladies being assaulted in their homes. In August of this year, an 11-year-old boy was abducted just after his mother dropped him off to go to school in Livingston near Edinburgh in Scotland. His body was found 3 days later. He'd been murdered by a man who was due to go to court to be charged with child abuse offences. The newspapers reporting the story discovered at least 6 other paedophiles living freely within walking distance of where this little boy's body was found. Don't we ask ourselves, what is going on? What's happening to society? Brethren, whatever way we want to look at it, we are living in fearful times. But should we let this get to us? Should we live in fear? Should we be victimized by feelings of fear? Well, it would be naive to think we will never be afraid. Spiritually stronger people than us have been afraid. Abram, for example, lied to Abimelech that Sarah was his sister because he was afraid that if he told the truth and said she was his wife, Abimelech would kill him or have him killed and take Sarah for herself. We read of this again, please note it down, I'm not turning to it. We read of this in Genesis chapter 20. He did the same on an earlier occasion when he was in Egypt, because then he feared that Pharaoh would take his wife from him, killing him in the process. That's Genesis 12. Isaac did the same thing when he was in Gerar, for the same reason. He was afraid he would be killed so that the men of Gerar could take his wife Rebecca from him. Seems in these days, gentlemen, it was a dangerous thing to have a beautiful wife. Not a good idea. Better with an ugly one in those days. What about Jacob? A man clearly blessed by God. Turn back to Genesis 32. Genesis 32. Genesis 32, we want to pick it up in verse 6. Genesis 32, verse 6. Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is also coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Verse 7. So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. Jacob was terrified out of his wits, because he feared what his brother might do as a result of he, Jacob, cheating him out of his birthright so many years before. Now, as we know, things turned out all right, but I'll come back to that later. Nehemiah was a faithful servant of God also, who trusted God implicitly, and was the one who organized the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. In carrying out this task, he showed great courage in contending with opposition and conspiracy against him, and also against the Jewish people. But look how he felt when he first broached the subject with King Artaxerxes, who was the conqueror of Israel at that time. Turn with me to Nehemiah chapter 2, please. Nehemiah chapter 2. Ezra, Nehemiah. Before Job. Ezra, Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2, reading verses 1 and 2. And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now Nehemiah was the king's cupbearer, in a very trusted position, because the king had to have somebody bringing his wine who he knew wouldn't try to poison him or anything like that. It came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that when wine was before him, that he took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I have never been sad in his presence before. Therefore the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, since you are not sick? There is nothing but sorrow in your heart." Then I became dreadfully afraid. Now if you read chapter 1, it's clear here that Nehemiah spent time petitioning God, God whom he loved and trusted. He petitioned him for favour with the king, but still here he was afraid to ask for what he wanted, which was simply permission to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall. What about Job? Another man who's a pillar of strength and also stubbornness. How could such a man ever fear? Well, look at Job chapter 9, please. Job chapter 9, a few pages on. Job chapter 9, and I want to read part of verse 28. It's a short part here. Sorry. That's right. Chapter 9, verse 28. In the first part of that, Job says, "I am afraid of my sufferings." This mighty man was afraid. Despite his strong character, he was afraid because he was suffering. What about King David? The man who, as a mere boy, slew the giant Goliath, killed wild animals with a stone from a sling, when a whole army was afraid to do these things. Enigmatically, David says he will not be afraid in Psalm 3. If you turn there, please. Psalm 3. Again, a few pages further on. Psalm 3, reading verses 5 and 6. Psalm 3, verse 5. "I lay down and slept, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. Now again, we'll come back to this later. But I think at the time David wrote this, he was not afraid for a particular reason. But he knew there would be times when he would be afraid. So go forward, please, to Psalm 56. Psalm 56. And there we want to note the first line of verse 3. Psalm 56, verse 3. Here David says, whenever I am afraid. Not, I will never be afraid, but whenever I am afraid. David, despite his great courage, knew there would be times when he would fear. We all know of Daniel and his sojourn in the lion's den. No fear there, although he was in the company of hungry wild beasts who would kill and eat just about anything. Fearless in what was without doubt an extreme situation, certainly not a situation he was in on a daily basis. So let's look at Daniel chapter 8, please. Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8. I want here to read verses 15 through 17. Daniel 8, 15 through 17. Verse 15. Now it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near me where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. Now consider this situation. Daniel knew God. He knew God well, and he knew God had protected him in the lion's den. He knew God worked with him and revealed to him the meaning of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He knew a messenger from God had revealed to him the meaning of his own dream in chapter 7. Now here he is having another vision. He sees an individual who looks like a man, but the insinuation is that he was not a man. Here's someone instructing this individual to explain the meaning of this vision to Daniel. And when that person approaches him, he's afraid. He fears. You would think he must have realized that this was from God, and the only one, and the one having the appearance of a man, was in fact an angel. So why was he afraid? These people were all people who were close to God, but they experienced fear. What then is fear anyway? Well, the dictionary definition goes something like this. Fear is a painful emotion excited by danger. Apprehension of danger or pain. Now think about it. Is this bad? Actually not, if you think about what it is saying. Fear basically can be a positive thing. That is so because if fear is triggered by danger, what it is designed to do is to make us clear out away from that danger, run away from it, if we can. In the examples we read from the Bible, fear caused Abram and Isaac to do something to protect themselves from a perceived danger. Now they used human reasoning and came to a wrong decision. But what they did was clearly wrong. Nevertheless, they reacted to the fear they felt, fear brought on by the danger they thought they were facing. So fear is one of the emotions God gives us to protect ourselves, to move away from danger. Yes, but also to avoid getting into danger. For example, we teach our children to fear playing with fire, to fear speaking to strangers, to fear taking drugs, to fear immoral acts. This is a healthy fear to stop them hurting themselves and perhaps ruining their lives. Turn with me please to Revelation. Revelation chapter 20. Revelation chapter 20, reading verses 13 through 15. Verse 13. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every man and woman, according to their work. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Now, exactly who is not going to be written in the book of life and suffer this fate of being cast into the lake of fire to be destroyed forever? Look over the page, please, to Revelation chapter 21. Revelation 21 and verse 8. My Bible says, but the cowardly, but it does mean fearful. So, but the fearful or the cowardly and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. This is the type of people who are not going to be in God's kingdom. They're going to be destroyed forever. And that the very first on the list is the fearful or cowardly. We looked at some of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Nehemiah, Job, David, and saw that all of them were at times fearful. But we also know from the scriptures, the Greek word translated fear in Revelation 21 is deilos, D-E-I-L-O-S. And that root, its root means timid, implying faithlessness and fearfulness. The kind of fear which we should not have is that fear which comes from a lack of trust in God. Go back with me now, please, to Genesis 32. We read earlier in verse 7 that Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed when he heard that Esau, his brother, whom he had double-crossed many years before, was on his way to meet him with 400 of his men. Now Jacob could have turned and ran away, but that would not have achieved anything positive. He would have become a kind of a fugitive. He'd also been told by God to return home. So if he ran away, he would be disobeying God's command. See, what he did is an example for us. When we find ourselves facing some situation that makes us afraid. Verse 9 of Genesis 32, please. Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will deal well with you. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, and the mother with the children. I will surely treat you well, and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. See, Jacob turned to God, and he reminded God of the promise he had made to him, and he asked God to deliver him from his brother, from this terrible fear that he had of his brother. Now later on in the chapter, there is recorded an incident where Jacob wrestles all night with Jesus Christ, again showing his tenaciousness and also faith in God. If you just flick over to verse 26, please, same chapter, verse 26. Now he, that is a capital H meaning Jesus Christ, now he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But he, small H meaning Jacob, said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. See, Jacob needed God's blessing at this time. And he knew and had faith in God that God could bless him. So he held on for that blessing. Now back to the story about Esau. The scriptures don't tell us what attitude Esau was in when he set out with his 400 men to meet Jacob. But let's see what actually happened. Chapter 33 and verse 1. Genesis 33 and verse 1. Now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked. And there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. No doubting what the pecking order was in that family. Verse 3, then they crossed over before them, and bowed themselves to the ground seven times, until he came near to his brother. So what did Esau do? Did he whack off Jacob's head with his sword? Beat him to a pulp? No, not at all. Verse 4. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him. He fell on his neck and kissed him. And they wept for happiness. Because Jacob had put his trust in God, he was able to function properly, despite the fear he felt. And everything turned out right in the end. Not forgetting Jacob, was through all of this following God's commands. There is no doubt that we, as people have in the past, live in fearful times. Fearful times because we live in a world that has forsaken the one true God and His Son, Jesus Christ. A world that would be without fear if the commandments laid out in Exodus 20 alone were obeyed by everybody. Whether we like it or not, we are affected by the fears of this world. Sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. You know, for example, there is right now, there has been, fears that oil supplies would go into decline because of various reasons, war and these great hurricanes. So the price of oil and energy goes up. Well, that's a fear affecting us indirectly. Because it's nothing to do with us directly, but indirectly it affects us. And it hits our pockets. We will hear of companies paying off hundreds of workers and warnings that the economy is going into decline. That leads to fears that we might lose our jobs. The legacy of terrorist bombings do create a fear and uncertainty when we need to travel. And when these or any other fears enter our mind, then we need to remember that we have a promise from our Heavenly Father and our Saviour Jesus Christ. Not a promise that we will not be afraid, that we will not experience fear, but a promise that helps us to handle it and not to lose faith or hope. Let me quote you a little bit from the inaugural speech made by F.D. Roosevelt in 1933. This is what he said. Let me first of all assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes efforts to convert retreat into advance. This is no unsolvable problem. For us, brethren, this is no unsolvable problem. Turn to Hebrews 13 with me, please. Hebrews 13. Here there are some specific instructions that point to obedience to God. But let's read Hebrews 13, starting in verse 1. He says, let brotherly love continue. Now love is fulfilling the commandments. So if we have brotherly love, if we continue in that, we will be obeying God's commandments. Let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers. Now I don't think this means we invite anyone and everyone into our homes, but certainly we should be courteous and helpful to others when we can, and especially to those who are our brothers and sisters in Christ. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. Have you ever given some old clothes to a gypsy who called at your door? Have you ever bought a cup of tea for that old tramp you saw sitting down the road? If you did, you might have been serving an angel. Now, of course, we have to be discerning. If someone approaches you filthy and reeking of alcohol, I would doubt that they're an angel in disguise. In verse 3, we are entreated to remember those who are wrongly imprisoned or mistreated for their faith. And verse 4 talks about the need for fidelity in marriage. But please drop down to verse 5. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Again, still talking about obeying the commandments. And be content with such things as you have. And those who are not content with what they have can become materialistic. And that then becomes their God, and their golden life is not serving the true God. And be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Now this is referring to promises God made to his people in at least three places in the Old Testament. Again, please note these down. Genesis 28:15, Deuteronomy 31:6-8, and Joshua 1:5. In fact, let's look at Genesis 28:15. Let's look at that one. Genesis 28:15. Just note the other one as well. Genesis 28:15. God says, behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. That applies to us, brethren. We are called And God will not leave us until He's done what He's spoken to us, until He leads us in the way that we need to go to be part of His family, part of His kingdom. Verse 6 of Hebrews 13, if you can click back there, please. Verse 6 of Hebrews 13. He says, "So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear what man can do to me." We will not fear what man can do to us, what he can produce that might make us afraid. We will not fear that because we have the greater promise of God. Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. Matthew 10, 28. And it says here, "And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." You know, only God can kill both body and soul or spirit in hell. It's God we need to strive to obey. It's God we need to fear, as Mr. Messier referred to this morning in his sermon. Remember the parable of the talents, brethren, in Matthew 25? If you could go over there, please. Matthew 25. I'll not read all of this. It starts at verse 14, but I'll not read all of it because we actually know it all. It's about a master who is representative of Christ. He gives talents to three of his servants. One gets five, one gets two, and the third one gets one. The first two servants use their talents profitably, meaning they grow spiritually. The third buried his talent in the ground and did nothing with it. When the master returned, he was pleased with the first two servants who had used their talents, and he rewarded them handsomely. Well, what about the third servant? Please read with me what he said to the master when he was asked what he'd done with the talent. That's verse 24. Verse 24. Matthew 25. "Then he who had received the one talent came and said, 'Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown, and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid, and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there, what you have is yours.' What was he afraid of? Was he afraid he would be ridiculed for his beliefs? Was he afraid some terrorist might target him for his beliefs? Was he afraid he might lose his job because of beliefs? Was he afraid his family might disown him for his beliefs? Was he afraid that people might not deal with him for his beliefs and he would not be able to buy food, etc.? Was he so afraid that he would rather please man than God?" Luke 9, please. Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, verse 26. This was this man. 9:26. "For whosoever is ashamed of me," the servant was ashamed of God, "and my words of him, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his own glory, and in his Father's and of the holy angels." This individual, although it's a parable, such individuals will go to the lake of fire. God will be ashamed of them because they were afraid to serve him. This is the fearful individual who's referred to in Revelation chapter 21, verse 8. He will not be accepted into God's kingdom. Not those who naturally from time to time feel afraid of or something, but those who fear to obey and serve God. It is the person who allows fear to prevent him or her getting on with their lives and obeying and serving God who will be the fall guys. To sum up then, brethren, it is not sinful or wrong in any way to be afraid of certain things and situations. This fear is a protective emotion. However, to overcome fear, we must always strive to obey God and turn to Him for help. We read how He has promised never, never to forsake us or to leave us. We must never allow fear to distance us from God or hinder us from living in obedience to God and as full a life as we possibly can. God always provides a way of escape. There are many recorded instances when God has saved his people from a terrifying situation. We read of some earlier in the Bible. In our time, I've heard of God's people being protected from rampaging mobs in Northern Ireland during the height of the troubles there. These mobs, and there was one instance I heard where a few people were heading to go for a meal one Sabbath before services, and this mob came around them, beating and thumping everybody round about. And it was almost as if they didn't see God's people. They walked around them and walked on. They weren't there as far as they were concerned. There was an incident I heard of, now I cannot back this up, but I heard of it, I've been told of it by several people. It happened in the USA some years ago, in the early years of the church. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a steel works. I used to work for a steel company, British Steel. And they're quite scary places, steel works. You've got molten metal all over the place. You've got big ingots of red hot steel shooting back and forward. They've got these huge crucibles full of molten steel moving about. Now, there was a gentleman in the church who worked at the steel works, and he was in an area where a crucible of molten iron was being moved. And for some unknown reason, the crucible was dislodged from its crane, and the superheated molten metal poured onto the factory floor. Now, this guy was there on the floor. He was right in the path of this torrent of death, with nowhere to run. Do you think he was afraid? He was terrified. His colleagues looked on with horror at what they were convinced was the last time they would ever see this guy alive. The heat alone should have vaporized him, even before the molten metal reached him. To their amazement, when the torrent of metal had passed, he was still there, totally unscathed. Now, who did that? That could only have been God. There was another incident reported in, I'm pretty sure it was Global's publications before we split, where a lady, a member of the church, was walking home with a colleague one day after work. Now, they were aware of being followed by a man. It came to the point where they part company and go their separate ways to their individual homes. And this lady was relieved that this man had disappeared. He wasn't there anymore. Now, unfortunately, he was still there. He followed her colleague and he treated her very badly. He assaulted her and beat her up. Now, they caught the guy. The police caught the guy. And they asked him, why did you choose that woman to assault rather than that woman who was the woman in the church? And his reply was, there's no way that I could have got through to her. These two guys, these two massive guys were walking beside her all the time. I couldn't have tackled them. There was nobody beside the woman. She was on her own. So who do you think he saw? He saw two angels. God was protecting that woman. This thug saw two angels looking after this woman. Amazing. See, God can protect us. You know, as God's people, we need to be realistic and accept that there will be times when we will face frightening situations, physical and emotional. Many of God's people will see they've gone through some terrifying experiences, but God always eventually provides a way out. Now, sometimes we've got to accept that way out is death. And on occasions we realize this, and we'll say, well, that person's death was a blessing in disguise, because we have the promise of the resurrection. But these cases are not very many. There's few of these. If we bear in mind God's promises that he will never leave us or forsake us, and resolve that no matter what happens in our life, we will continue to serve and obey God to the best of our ability, then we will be able to cope with all the fearful situations that exist in this world of which we've been discussing today. And may from time to time affect us. And we will go on to be accepted into God's kingdom, because we will not be amongst the fearful, spoken of in Revelation 21 and verse 8.